Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Wilkin Brutus. It was just 2 years after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, 1970, when Bee Hines was hired as a reporter at the Miami Herald. She was the first black female journalist in that position. That time is often cited as the end of the civil rights movement. First, the Civil Rights Act was passed, which on paper banned discrimination, followed by the Voting Rights and Fair Housing Acts. But it was only the beginning of change. And for Bee, her dream of being a journalist was coming true. It's one she still lives to this day. At 85, she continues to write her column and still goes out in the field. She recently went on a history tour to Rosewood, Florida. She visited the gravesites of black Floridians who were the victims of racial violence. Some of those tragedies happened just a few generations ago. One of her most recent columns was about that experience. Bee Hines joins us in the radio now to talk about all of this and more. Bee, how are you?
I am just doing very well and just happy to be here. Thank you.
You staying hydrated? I got my water.
You got my water right here.
You got your water. Oh, you got La Croix. Coconut?
Coconut.
You didn't bring me any?
Somebody, it's a gift.
Oh, it's a gift.
From your studio.
Oh, my own studio is not even giving me any gifts. First of all, thank you well in advance for all that you've accomplished. I wouldn't be here if it weren't for you. I just want to let you know that. What kinds of dreams were encouraged and disencouraged or discouraged at home growing up?
Okay. I was always a curious child. And my mother worked as a maid, and she would bring home books. And my favorite pastime was on a rainy day was to sit under the table with the tablecloth hanging down and read. It was my own private space. And one of the things my mother did not encourage was my love of the arts, because I love to draw, I love to sing, and I love to write. So she never encouraged that, because my mother was from an era where she didn't see blacks doing those kinds of things and making money. And she always thought I was such a dreamer that I would probably starve to death. She'd have to take care of me for the rest of her life. So she never encouraged my dreams. In fact, I got a scholarship when I was a senior in high school, graduating senior in voice at Knoxville College, which she never let me take. And so when I got married a year later, and then I had my children, I had two sons, and by the time I was 24, I was a widow. And so we lived together, my mother and I lived together, and I went back to school at night, and I never could tell her. Well, at first she thought I was studying to become a teacher, but by that time I had gotten a job at the Miami Herald as a library file clerk, and this was in 1966. And so I was going back to school. I started back to school in 1967. But then I met a man named Fred Shaw, who was a vice president of development at that time at Miami-Dade North Campus. And he was also the book editor at the Miami Herald.
And before we get to him, I want to go back to the fact that your mother didn't encourage you at first.
Right.
You talk about the time period where they didn't see this as an option for
exactly.
you because it didn't make money. Did they also assume that you should be a lawyer, an engineer, doctor? What was their mindset?
Not too many parents encouraged their children. That's why we didn't have that many black lawyers, engineers at that time. I didn't know any black engineers when I was growing up, but I did know two black lawyers, actually three. But that was my mom thought that if I became a teacher or a nurse. Nursing was her. She wanted always that. She loved, she was a natural nurse, but never had the opportunity to study nursing. So she wanted to live out her dream through me. And I am a person who can hardly stand the sight of blood. So I knew that was not going to be something, but I love children.
Right.
So teaching would have been a good profession for me.
And so without that encouragement, what kept you going on that particular creative mindset?
That's why I was getting to Mr. Shaw, because one night I asked him to read a paper that I had to turn in. And when he read it, he said, "What did you say you studied?" I said, I'm going to be a teacher. And he said, "Well, you need to change your major to journalism because you can write." And so I laughed, because I'm working in the library and I'm lucky to be the only black in the Miami Herald Library. And I said, "Well, they're not going to hire me. They don't have any black reporters. So they're not going to hire me. I'm black." And he said, "B, they are things are changing and you need to be ready for the change. And I took his advice and I changed my major to journalism. However, I never told my mom. And the reason I didn't tell her was because my mother still thought I was full of pipe dreams and, you know, and I would never get a job as a reporter.
And when he said things were changing, what did he mean by that?
He meant the situation in society, the status of blacks, things were changing. More opportunities were becoming available to black people.
Did he feel you had the capability to sort of chronicle that change?
You know, he lived to see me become a reporter, and he was so proud of me. He was, and I'm so glad it happened in his lifetime, you know, before he died. He died fairly young. I don't think Mr. Shaw was even 60 when he died. He might have been, he had a heart attack.
Would you consider him like an idol?
I consider him my mentor, of course. Yes.
And for the industry itself, who did you sort of look up to give you the template? I mean, you were the first black reporter. What sort of template did you run off?
Okay. When I started writing, studying journalism at Miami-Dade, I also met a woman named Barbara Garfunkel, who was my teacher, who was one of my teachers. And she made me get on the Falcon Times newspaper. That was the Miami-Dade's campus paper. And so writing articles, and then I had two friends at the Miami Herald who were reporters. One was the assistant editor in the, we called it For and About Women back then, but it became the features department later on. Helen Corum, who was my age, and Juanita, who was about almost 10 years older, wanted to see some of my articles. And they took my articles to the managing editor, who was Larry Jenks at the time, and demanded that he hire me, and he did. But Larry forgot to tell me first.
Everybody knew
that I was going to be a reporter, but me.
How did you feel?
Well, I was excited. I was too excited to be angry, you know. And the funny thing about life is the way, and I'm a religious person. I'm a Christian, and I believe that things work out for a reason. They all happen for a reason.
And you've been quite outspoken about your faith in your column and interviews. Is that something that began in your childhood?
I always wanted to be a good person. Even when I was a child, I didn't know anything about how to become a good person. I didn't know about giving my heart to the Lord, but I always wanted to be a good person, and I was always a kind person. And so as I got older and understood, you know, what it meant to be a Christian, I was 23 when I really gave my heart to the Lord.
What do you think sort of inspired you to give your heart to the Lord?
As I said, I wanted to make sure that when the Lord comes back, I would be going back with him. I don't want to be left behind.
This was a smart decision on your part,
right,
that you were making.
And then I wanted to make an impact in the lives of other people. I wanted to be able to draw other people away from, you know, things that would hurt them in their life. You know, and I have not been that lucky sometimes, fortunate in my own family. You know, you want to everybody to turn to the Lord or to give their hearts or to just be a decent person, you know. And sometimes you win some and sometimes you lose some.
How has your faith influenced your journalism career?
In practically every way, because I totally lean on the Lord. I pray before I write a column. I ask God to give me something that will be inspiring to somebody. Maybe somebody will read this column, and they're pretty down in the dumps, and they'll read this column and it will kind of lift their spirits. And that's what I want. I want to be able to be a help. I want, when I leave this life, I want to be able for somebody to say that I passed this way and that I was a help to them. And I don't give myself any flowers, pat myself on the back. I give all the glory to God.
Have you gotten feedback from readers for sharing your
all
faith?
All the time.
What sort
of
feedback?
Which surprised me. They write me letters, emails, and tell me how they are inspired by my faith journey, and that I, the fact that I that I'm not ashamed to talk about my faith and to share it. And that inspires me to do more. You know, I'm not a preachy type person. I have not been called to preach.
You're not trying to proselytize people.
I'm not. I just want people to see my life and to know that this is a life that can be lived through anyone. You know, I am nothing special, you know, except that God made who I am. Right. And so I just want people to say, okay, if B can do this, and I know some of the things she's gone through, then I can do it too.
Hmm. You talked about, you know, finding God at the age of 23. Let's go to your childhood. Where in South Florida were you? Where did you grow up?
I was born right here in Florida, in Williston, Florida. And my mother was married to an abusive man. And when she was only 24, she escaped. I like to use that word, escaped. And we had a neighbor who we called Mud Deer. Just like Tyler Perry's Mud Deer.
Oh, my dear.
And she helped my mother. My mom would get up early in the morning and make my dad's breakfast, and I used to get up with him. And he would sit me on his lap. He was abusive to my mother, but he was never abusive to us, to me and my brother. And I would drink coffee from the saucer. And then the truck would pick him up and he would go to work. Oh. And this particular morning, my mother, she was a wonderful housekeeper. And she had washed and ironed all week. She had all of his nice shirts hanging up in the closet and his work clothes nice and clean. And then she packed our stuff as she was doing it. So the morning that we left, as soon as my mother kissed my dad goodbye, and he didn't know it was for the last time, and I remember seeing her swirl around from the door, went and got my brother up, and here comes my dear, who came over, and she helped. She combed my hair while my mother got my baby brother dressed. And in a little while, they had made arrangements for a man who was driving a lumber truck to come by. And he took that big truck and swung it up on the back of the truck and lifted me up into the cab and then helped my mother up. And then I could see my dear crying, handing my baby brother to my mother.
And I think it's fair for us for folks who are listening right now to describe this Madea character.
Yes.
You mentioned Tyler Perry, and it's essentially like a wild grandmother character.
That's who was right. And she was not related to us, but she took my mother under her wings because she had a daughter who was married to my dad's brother. And she also was abused.
So would you say you essentially lived in a village? Almost.
Well, it was
people
a village.
Looked out for themselves.
People looked out for each other. And so she took my mother under her wing. And years later, they moved to Miami. By the time I was a mother, she also babysat for my children, and they loved her.
And this was the Liberty Square neighborhood?
No, this was, my children came along, I was no longer living in the Liberty Square housing project. We moved there when I was 13.
And I think it was called the Poke and Bean Project.
No, it was not Poke.
No?
It was a lovely place then to live. It had the only playground at the time for black children. And when we lived overtown, we would ride number 21 bus on Sunday afternoons after church and ride all the way to Liberty City so we could take a chance on the swings.
Wow.
A ride on the swings in the park.
And what was that experience like to be a child at the only playground for black children?
We didn't know it was the only playground. You know, it's a funny thing about children. We don't see the evil that's around us. The children don't see. You got to teach children to be ugly and to be evil and to be hateful. We never knew that this wasn't the way it was, you know, that other children had to stand on line for a chance to swing. We didn't know that this was the only black playground at the time. I learned that later on.
Let's talk about that sort of consciousness, that double consciousness in a way. So you say you didn't even realize that this was an all black playground for children because, again, you're a child just playing.
Child.
When did you become, I guess the term is racialized? When did you start seeing yourself as a black person that is affected by the social conditions that you were living under?
As I was growing up, and when we were still living in Overtown, and this was during the war, and things were being rationed, like toilet paper and other things were being rationed. And the house where we lived, my mother rented a room at a big house on, the address was 135 Northwest 1st, 9th Street.
You still remember it?
I do. It was a beautiful home. And the owners were, their father was white. And they had turned it in after, I guess, the 29 crash. They turned it into a rooming house. It had servants' quarters on the backs. And they rented them out to families. And so my mother was able to get a nice big room for us when she came from Williston here. We stayed with my auntie in Palatka, Florida, until she found a job in Miami. And she got a job at the Southern Furniture Store, which was right across the street. She could go upstairs and look at us playing in the yard. So we didn't have to have a babysitter. And then she came home and fed us lunch and went back to work.
I love this through line, this reoccurring theme about the village and how you have these different characters around your life that has helped in so many different ways. What does that neighborhood look like now? Have you been able to go back and sort of reminisce?
Yes, it's the 9th Street corridor now in Overtown. It's right just across from the Lyric Theater. And there's a nice big, where my house used to stand, there is a nice apartment building there now, facing First Court. And it's nothing like it used to be. Before the apartment building came, it was the parking lot for the old Heat Stadium. And then they moved to Biscayne. And so now that property is, this is a nice apartment building there. Overtown is so much different than what it was when I was growing up. When I was a child growing up in there on 9th Street, and we would have the parades, FAMU, it was FAMC at the time. Florida A&M College, but they were the only black college that could play in the Orange Bowl at the time. And they would have the big games, and it was a whole weekend. It was the Orange Blossom Classic. And my mother would get us up very early to see the parade on Saturday mornings. And at that time, this Second Avenue was like a sunken street, and the curb sat up. So we would go and get our spots right there on the curb and sit so we could watch the parade, FAMU, FAMC, strutting down the Second Avenue. It was an exciting time.
You have a historical marker in your mind that just kind of sits there, waiting to be explored. I really love that. Stay with me. We're on Sundial right now. This is Wilk and Brutus. We're speaking with the legendary Bee Hines. She's a Miami Herald columnist, the first black female reporter hired by the Miami Herald. Let's go back to journalism. Bee, you've talked about how it was your dream to be a journalist. What sparked that dream? What was it about journalism itself that attracted you?
Well, I didn't know that I would actually become a journalist. I thought I would probably end up writing the great American novel. Because, as I said, I didn't see any role model. My role model for a reporter was Brenda Starr, the comic strip. That was a woman reporter in the comics. She's no longer, you're too young to remember that.
Well, take me there.
But some people remember when Brenda Starr, who dressed beautifully, whoever drew the strip, always had her dressing very pretty. And she was smart, and she always had these very exotic adventures, you know, as a reporter, where she had to go get the story from some foreign place. So I was going to be Brenda Starr if I could. But since I couldn't be Brenda Starr, I was going to write the great American novel.
Wow.
Which still hasn't happened.
what are you waiting for?
Well, I'm just busy. I don't know what I'm waiting for. I started it. I started my memoirs, and I haven't finished it. I did finish a children's book. It's called The Ugly Feeling. And my former daughter-in-law and I, she's an accomplished artist, Marianne Holiday, and she did the illustrations for me. We self-published. It hadn't gone anywhere yet because we didn't have the money to, we gave money to somebody to, you know, to put it out there. And now we got a suit because they didn't do anything.
Wow.
Took our money. But anyway, we realized that things like that happen sometimes.
So and what inspired that children's book?
As a little girl, I have a brother who is, he was always so cute. And he's light skinned. And as you know, being a black person, and even among us, we have that caste system where if you're light, you're fine. And if you're dark, you're not. And so my brother was always the favorite of all my mother's friends. So I didn't think I was pretty. And I would be jealous of my friends who were. And people would say, oh, she's so cute. And then they, you know, children have ears, adult people. I want you to know this. When people would say to my mother, oh, she should have been the little boy and he should have been the little girl. And they didn't realize how that hurt me. And I was a little girl, but I heard that. And so I was inspired by those memories to write this book. And it's called The Feeling of Jealousy. It's called The Ugly Feeling. The little girl knew how she felt when somebody complimented her friends and didn't compliment her, but she didn't know what to call the feeling. So she called it the ugly feeling. And then somebody explained to her that she was pretty and she understood. And her mother explained what the feeling was. And a woman who loved her, who had a little, and this was in real life. I had a woman who owned a little mom and pop store next door to where we lived. She loved me and she thought I was so sweet. And that one of the last conversations we had when I was about 9 years old, she said, when I'm well, we're going to go out to dinner, just the two of us. And but she died before she could. I remember her to this day.
You're 85 years old and
I'm
still
85, and
sticks
that,
with you.
That I still remember that. She did something for me that a lot of people didn't do. She made me feel pretty.
Keep that thought. I'm just listening to you right now, and it is absolutely mesmerizing. We're on Sundial. This is Wilk and Brutus. We're speaking to B. Hines. Talk to you guys soon. We're coming back. We're back on Sundial. This is Wilk and Brutus. We're speaking with B. Hines. She's a Miami Herald columnist, the first black female reporter hired by the Miami Herald. And we have been going through a myriad of stories. And I think we should go back to that book you were thinking about writing. You discuss some of the colorism that you've experienced as a child. Again, 85 years old, some of these memories are still attached to your mind, to your spirit. Mm-hmm. And you describe the premise of this book. Do you feel in this day and age where racial politics is heightened more, I wouldn't say more than ever, but certainly in the past few years, especially during the advent of social media right now, do you still feel inspired to sort of launch this book?
I am inspired. Sometimes I get up thinking, you know, you're 85 already. You don't have that much time, so maybe you just need to scratch this. But I don't know. I may be around here till I'm 100. My grandmother was 101 so when she passed. So, and she still had a good mind. So I think I'm just going to pick up where I left off and finish it. You know, and if I'm not around to see it published, my children, somebody will publish it.
Yeah.
And it can be used and read for generations to come.
Let's segue back to journalism, which is what you're still doing right now.
Right.
You're the longest serving reporter and columnist for the Miami Herald. In a recent interview with the Herald, you said to never share your dreams with everyone because not everyone will understand your dream. What sort of experience gave you that realization? Because you sound like my mom, who have told me in the past, hey, Wilkin, don't share your dreams. Keep it to yourself.
That's
because
right.
Some people attack it.
And they will.
And so what helped you come to that realization?
Well, I had just changed my major to journalism, and my youngest son was still in kindergarten, and I was dropping him off that morning, and the woman who was the head of the kindergarten and a friend of mine who was in my class, they met me at the, you know, they were standing at the gate for the children when their parents were dropping them off, and so they knew that I had started school again, and my friend who graduated with me and who was one of the teachers, she said, B, what are you studying? And I said, I'm studying journalism. And the other woman laughed. I mean, she really laughed out loud. And she said, girl, where do you think you're going to get a job in journalism? You know, and I said, just what Fred Shaw said to me, things are changing and I'm going to be ready for the change. And then 4 years later, when I became a journalist, she was the first person to come and congratulate me.
How did that feel?
It felt wonderful. And I was glad that she had the nerve and that she had, that she would admit that she was wrong and come and say, you were right. And I congratulate you.
Did that surprise you at all?
It did. I didn't think she would do that, but she did. And at that time, my classmates, my high school classmates, many of them were working as teachers, and one was a lawyer in town. They were all working right in town, and nurses. And they were all so proud of me because they had been working like 10 years at their profession when I became a reporter. I was 32. When I became a reporter. And they were so proud of me. They would organize luncheons to take me out to lunch. And that made me feel really well. I was so happy that they were proud of me.
You know how you try to like justify why someone thinks a certain way, especially in regards to your dreams? Why do you think your friend thought journalism was too far-fetched for you?
Because they didn't see any black journalists in Miami at that time. We're talking 1967, 68. There were no black journalists. It wasn't until a little while later that the Miami Herald hired its first black reporter, who was also an elementary school friend of mine, Thurley Smith. And he was the late Thurley Smith. He passed some years ago. But his sister is Congresswoman Frederica Wilson. And I've known them. I've known Miss Congresswoman Wilson since she was in big hair bows in the second grade. Her brother and I were classmates.
I'm sure she's gonna hear this and start laughing.
I tell that all the time. She's so sweet. She knows. And her brother and I were best friends. Yeah.
Now you became a journalist not because you were black, but because of merit, right? You did it because you were good at your job. You were great at writing. For young journalists and people from many professions who express thoughts about quote imposter syndrome or self doubt, did you ever go through that in the early stages of your career?
I did. I think because I didn't have as much training as some of the other journalists had. And then I was this black woman who was green and who was a woman and thrust into this city room with mostly white males. I mean, there was not another black person in the newsroom. And there were only a handful of women in the newsroom at the time. Most of the women worked in the Living Today section. They had changed it from For and About Women to the Living Today section at that time. And then it was later called Living, which became our... where we put our features. But I really didn't know what to expect. And so there were times, but one of the things I said I was not going to do, I knew there would be times when an editor would disagree with me. I purposed in my heart that I wouldn't say he or she disagreed with me because I'm black. I didn't want to jump on that bandwagon, even when I knew they were doing things to me because I was black. I never wanted to jump on that bandwagon. That you can't do that.
What drove you to take that stance?
Because I wanted to think the best about people. Even when they sent me on the wild goose chases and I knew they were doing the wrong thing, I'd come back into the office and I would never accuse them.
You were basically picking your battles, essentially.
That's what you have to do. You have to pick your battles. And also you have to do it with a sense of humor. I had an editor who just did not like me and tried to ruin my career.
In what way?
In every way. Would give me assignments that she wouldn't give anybody else. Or she would ask for a list of story ideas and she would run a red line through all of them. And then she would say, this person had this idea first. And so I started going behind her back and they never had that idea. But anyway, when I was starting out as a reporter, the journalists dressed nicely. They looked really, the men always wore a tie, and a shirt, and some of them wore jackets. But all the women looked nice. All the women dressed up. And I was a person who, I like fashions, but I know how to sew. And because I had two children, I couldn't spend a lot of money on myself. So I made my things, and I could sew very well. So they didn't look like they were homemade. And I knew how to pick the fabric, the right fabric for the right pattern. So one day she called me into her office, and she wanted to know how could I afford to dress the way I dressed. So I'm thinking, well, am I making that much less than everybody else? And, what's going on here? And so I said, well, you know, I know how to find sales and I know how to sew. And so I told my girlfriend, she was my mentor, Juanita Green, who was also white. And I told her what she said. And Juanita said to me, okay, tomorrow they had matching blazers. Velvet blazers were the thing back at that time. Velvet blazers. And she said, okay, tomorrow wear a skirt to match my blazer and a blouse and get here early. And I did. And I put on Juanita's blazer with my skirt and I was dressed to kill. And she could not, the woman who hated me, was mad as a rattlesnake, but she couldn't say anything the whole day. I was wearing a blazer just like hers.
Was that one of your humorous ways
that
of handling?
That was one of my, and all day long, Juanita Green and I walked past each other in the car, and we would look at each other and we would just crack up because we had won.
And in terms, I mean, you're a black woman in this newsroom, the only black woman. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, I got to go with hairstyle. How did you look like on a typical day?
Well, on a typical day, when I first started writing, I was wearing my hair natural. And so then I started, it was kind of hard because at night I'd have to braid it up. And sometimes I'd be too tired, you know, so it'd be nice and fluffy the next morning. Because I've got this real kinky hair. It's thick and kinky, you know, but I wouldn't trade it for anything. But then I started straightening it and curling it. What I would do was pull it out with the curling irons and curl it. It was really pretty. And that was easier to care for than having to braid it up every night. But nobody seemed to mind. I always dressed well.
Really? So mm-hmm. So you didn't feel pressure at the time to wear your hair as a black woman in a certain way?
No, I wore my hair natural when I first became a reporter for 9 years before I started straightening it. And I never felt pressured to wear it in a certain way.
That's an amazing experience mm-hmm. because you typically hear black journalists mm-hmm. who enter, you know, newsrooms and feel the pressure, and not just journalism, corporate America in
right.
general.
That sort of came on a little later on. They never bothered me about my hair. I was always neat. I dressed nicely and my hair was done nicely. And so they never bothered me.
Yeah,
I just started back being natural in 2020 when I had knee surgery and the anesthesia took my hair out. Hmm. So I just cut it off.
Take me to your first story. Do you remember your first story?
Yes. My first story was, you remember I said to you that things happen for a reason?
Yes.
Well, when Larry Jenks told me that I would start my job in the newsroom in 2 weeks from the day we spoke, mm-hmm. And the night before I was to start my job, a riot broke out in Liberty City. So when I came to work that day, he asked me if I was afraid to cover the riot. I didn't even know the riot was going on. I didn't have a TV and I didn't have the radio on as I went to go to bed early because I had this big job that was starting the next day.
And what was the riot about?
The riot, it started when a welfare mother was trying to cash her check in a grocery store on 62nd Street. I think it was 54th Street and about 27th Avenue. It's gone now. And they were charging her too much. And she got into an argument and some men jumped in. And it just escalated from there. And so I didn't know this was going on. That store was eventually burned down. And so when Larry Jenks asked me if I was afraid to cover the riot, and I said to myself, is Brer Rabbit scared of the briar patch? Because I lived in Liberty City. I felt like I'm home. And so I went out to cover the riot. I didn't have credentials. That was my first day on the job. They didn't even have time to give me a press card. And so I wrote Larry Jenks' number on a piece of paper. And they didn't want people walking the street in Liberty City. So here I am all dressed up like Brenda Starr in my high-heel shoes.
Brenda Starr is never going away. She's
no,
there.
She's
right
away.
On your shoulders in every chapter of your life. Brenda Starr is there.
So I would go up to each police car and I'd say, okay, I'm covering a riot and this is my name and this is the number of my managing editor if you want to check on me. And I would give this to all the cops that were on the corner. And I passed one store and two men were standing in the doorway. And as I walked past, one of them said, I heard one say, hey man, this riot is is hurting my business. And I backed up. I said, excuse me, sir. I said, what is your business? I'm a reporter. And he said, I'm a hustler. And he said his name was Iceberg Slim.
Iceberg Slim.
But it wasn't the real Iceberg Slim. You know, that's what he called himself because he was hustling women. So I wrote a little story. I went back to the office and I said, I think I have a story. And Larry Jenks was happy for it because it was sort of lighthearted and so much ugliness was happening. And so they put it on the front page. It was only about 6 inches long.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, but it was my first
story. I know you were. Were you happy and excited?
I was so proud. I was so happy. I was.
And so let's go back before that very moment. Of you producing your first story. Mm-hmm. Before becoming a reporter, you worked as a maid. Tell me about that particular experience.
Okay. When I was getting ready, I think the one thing that made me realize that I could do better was when the family that I worked for two families. One woman was a career woman. I worked for her on Mondays. She was never home. She would put out a broken dish and a chipped cup and tarnished silverware, and that's what I was supposed to use to eat my lunch. Well, and then she would say to me, Beatrice, I want you to clean the bathroom last. Now, you know why she wanted me to do that. So what I did was when she went to work, I used the good silverware and the nice plates, and I didn't use the chip cups if I ate at all. And then I cleaned the bathroom first. It was my little protest because I knew why she was telling me to do that. And it was so funny because this woman would give a part of her tithing to my church every month. She thought she was a good person. Mm-hmm. And I believe she really wanted to be, but that was the way she was raised.
And that humor, there you go, using that humor.
So you had to do what you had to do.
You had to do what you had to do. Stay with me.
So when I was, the other family had children. And so, she would always say, maids are a dime a dozen. And one year they went away and left me stranded for 4 weeks. But I had friends who wanted to have some time off, and I worked in their place, and that's what carried me over through the summer. And I was so angry that she would do that to me, because other maids that I knew, if their people went off, they would leave them with money while they were gone, because they wanted to keep them. But she thought maids were a dime a dozen, and she didn't. But she didn't know they were not all like me. Mm-hmm. I loved her children like I loved my own. I did extra things for hem dresses. You know, I did little things that I didn't have to do as a maid. So when I found the job in the paper, I found the ad that the Miami Herald was looking for a file clerk. And all at that time, businesses had to say, we are an equal opportunity employer. And so they didn't have a telephone number to call. They had a post office box where I had to write a letter. So I wrote a letter of application. I didn't have a typewriter. I have a nice handwriting, so I took my time and wrote it in longhand. And I was called in for an interview. And I took a test, and they hired me, called me like the next day and said I was hired if I wanted the job. And could I start that following Monday? And I said, I would like to give the people I work for at least a 2 weeks notice, which is what they wouldn't have done for me. And they said, okay, then you'll start the first Monday in January. Hmm. And that's what I did. But when I went to the woman that I was working for and told her I had this new job that I was going to go to, she thought I wanted a raise when I said I wanted to talk to her. And so she says, when I told her I had a new job, and she flopped down in the nearest chair, she was so upset.
Wow.
And she said, that's not going to work. That's not going to last. As soon as President Johnson is out of the chair, things are going to go back to the way they used to be. Hmm. That's what she said to me.
Stay with me. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick little break. You're listening to Sundial with Wilkin Brutus, and we are talking to Bea Hines. Talk to you guys soon. Welcome back to Sundial. This is Wilkin Brutus. I'm speaking to Miami Herald columnist Bea Hines. We have been going through a lot of different stories, a lot of different characters involved in your stories, Bea. You recently went on a history tour in Florida. For those who are unfamiliar, what is Teach the Truth Tour?
Okay, this is something that Dr. Marvin Dunn, a professor emeritus at FIU, who is a lover of history and has written several history books, Blacks, History of the Blacks in Miami, and also History of Blacks in Florida. And in his research, he uncovered a lot of lynchings and massacres and stuff like that that were done to Black people back in the 1800s and the early 1900s. And now with our governor wanting to shut down and erase all of the history from the history books and ban books, he went to Rosewood. He said the first time he went to Rosewood, it was like a side trip. He had not planned to go. He was alone. He had been to Gainesville for some reason. And on his way back, he took the road to Rosewood. And he said he parked his car and he started to walk in the woods. And he found this old railway bed. And then he saw a graveyard. And he began to read the names on it. And he thought, you know, I'm here by myself. Don't nobody know I'm here. And he started feeling uneasy, and so he started leaving to go back to his car. And he said as he was walking out of the woods, he could feel the spirits of those Black people who had been killed following him out, saying to him, I'm so glad you found us. Thank you. And so when he told me that, and I read about his first trip that he was taking, I tried to get on that trip, but I waited too late. So I got in touch with him. I said, on your next trip, I want to be on that bus. And he made it possible.
And you couldn't sleep the night before, right?
I couldn't. I could not sleep. I was so excited about going on that trip. I didn't know what I was going to see. I prayed. I always pray before I go anywhere or do anything. And once we got to the first gravesite of a Mr. Julius, they call him July Perry, who had been lynched in 1920. And it all started because he was trying to vote. A Black man who was a businessman who owned orange groves and had people working for him. And so he was trying to vote. And one thing led to another, and two white people got killed in his house from shots from the outside, which were fired by white people into his house. But they blamed him, and they arrested him, and an angry mob pulled him out of jail and lynched him. So when I went to his grave and touched his tombstone, the tears started, because I just felt him. I just felt what he tried to do and how he was treated and how he was tortured. And it just brought the tears.
One of the grave sites you visited was of a 15-year-old Black boy who wrote a love note to a white girl.
That's right.
What impact did this story have on you?
Oh my goodness. As a mother of sons, I thought about when they were writing their first love notes, because they were to, you know, my youngest son married a white girl. But I thought about them. And then I could see that mother when they pulled her child away from her and put him in the car, and she was running behind him on that dirt road, screaming for her child. She couldn't save him. I was 6 years old when they murdered him. But at that gravesite, I became his mother. I was his mother. And I felt her pain. I felt what my children could have experienced. It was just overwhelming.
And it's just that sense of empathy as a mother that no one can understand unless they are also mothers.
That's right. That's true.
You wrote about how you found hope during this history tour. Tell me about some of the Black joy.
Yeah. Okay. So we're sitting around, on this particular trip, some of the white people in the area worked with Marvin to plant azaleas and rose bushes around the property that he and a partner had bought in Rosewood, which he plans to make create a memorial park. And so we sat there, some of us who are older who didn't help plant, we sat at the railroad bed. And while we were sitting there talking, my mind was wondering, I'm looking at the trees and I'm wondering, if these trees could talk, what stories would they tell me? You know, how many black people have been hanging from these limbs? You know, I'm thinking these things. And then I look down and I see a baby oak tree pushing up through the leaves of the earth. And I thought, that's a sign of hope. And that made me happy.
Wow.
It was a sign of hope.
B, normally when I get happy, I sing.
I do too.
Yeah?
I sing too.
Are you a good, first of all, I'm a terrible singer.
I used to be a good singer, but I used to be a high soprano.
Really?
I sang first soprano, I sang alto. I had a wide range.
Well, you
now
still
I'm singing bass. Older you get, your voice changes, so I'm singing bass.
Yeah,
now.
But the older you get, it's kind of like fine wine, though. Do you still have a little bit in you?
I think so. I love to sing. I sing in church. I was a member of the choir, but they have to get up and down so much, I step down because my knees won't take all that getting up and sitting down. So, but I've been thinking about going. I used to sing for many years. I sang with the Miami Oratorio Society.
Can you give me something?
No.
Hopeful. You don't want to turn this into like a huge talent show?
Not today.
Oh, you did not know you were in the talent show?
Not today.
We tricked you. You're in the talent show.
But anyway, I've been saying I'm going back. I'm going to join them again because I love music and I love singing.
What is it about music that connects people to history and to stories?
You don't have to speak the language. When, in 1992, I believe it was, I sang with a group called Unity. And we went twice to Italy. People loved the music, so they didn't understand the language. But you could see the tears when we were singing. They were so emotional about what we were singing and the feeling that it gave them. So you don't have to speak the language. It's just something about music. Somebody said it's a universal language, and it is. It connects people.
Absolutely. Well, I think we're going to wrap up pretty soon. You're going to be on an online panel for Women's History Month on May 30th. And very briefly, what's that about?
I was asked to join this panel, and we're going to talk about where we were and how far we've come and that kind of thing. I think Beverly Johnson, who was the first black model to appear on Vogue, she's going to be one of the panelists along with myself and maybe a couple of other people.
All right. And folks who are interested, they can find out more information on WLRN.org. And we can go straight to, again, I just want to thank you for coming on. Behind what your story has been absolutely inspirational.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And it continues to be inspirational for a lot of folks, especially for people who want to join this journalism industry that's constantly shaping and changing.
I don't want it to die.
I mean, you don't think it'll die, right?
No, it won't. It's here forever. Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that's it for Sundial for Thursday, March 23rd. Leslie Avaya Atkinson is our lead producer. Elisa Bejena is our producer and social media editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's VP of News. Katie Munoz is our director of live programming. Peter J. Meritz is WLRN's vice president of radio and Sundial's engineer. Our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band, Palo, at gopalo.com. You can download a podcast of this program. Search WLRN Sundial on your podcast app. Coming up next week on our program, Defacing Michael Jackson. It's a new play by Orin Squire at the Colony Theater in Miami Beach. The coming-of-age story uses pop music to explore hero worship and belonging. The play is set in Opa-locka in the 1980s and is loosely based on Orin's childhood. I'm Wilkin Brutus. Thanks for listening and stay hydrated.
WLRN Public Media.